Hello and welcome to Conduit Conversations, bringing you pioneers at the cutting edge of social change. I'm Paul Fonsale, co-founder of The Conduit, a home for people passionate about positive impact.
I believe we're going to see unicorns that are not just worth $1 billion, but touch a billion lives.
My guest today is Sir Ronald Cohen, an international philanthropist, venture capitalist, private equity investor, and social innovator who has been described as the father of social investment. He's chairman of the Global Steering Group for Impact Investment, chairman and co-founder of the Portland Trust, co-founder of Social Finance UK, USA, and Israel, co-founder of Bridges Fund Management, and co-founder of Big Society Capital. Sir Ronald's pioneering initiatives have catalyzed a number of global efforts, each focused on driving private capital to serve social and environmental good. As a global philanthropist, he tackles issues ranging from Israeli-Palestinian peacebuilding to humanities and the arts and impact investing. We are honored and delighted to have you here, and welcome.
Thank you. Delighted to be here with you, Paul.
Can we start at the beginning? You were born in Egypt, fled to England during the Suez Canal crisis in the 1950s. Tell us about that experience, because I suspect it may contain the seeds of who you are today.
I think it almost certainly contains the seeds. For an 11-year-old, it was quite challenging experience, as you might expect. The secret police came to knock on the door of our home at night. My mother was placed under house arrest because she had a British passport. There was an X carved in the wall a couple of days later outside our home. My mother started selling the furniture to the neighbors so that my father wouldn't change his mind about leaving, because he kept thinking that this didn't make any sense and therefore it was unlikely to happen, that it would blow over. And we left with a suitcase and 10 Egyptian pounds each, basically. And we were very lucky to be welcomed in the UK. I went to a state school. I had to learn English during the summer. I was lucky, basically. I landed in a school where there was a new headmaster, an unbelievable history teacher who coached me eventually for my entrance exams to Oxford, and I got into Oxford. But I suppose, looking back, Paul, I left with the sense that life in Egypt had actually been good for Jews, and that something had happened to change that. And that was sort of, I now have been able to define it in ways I couldn't have defined it then, as a sort of resurgence of nationalism. And at the end of the day, relations between Jews, Christians, and Arabs in Egypt had really been an example for a century almost. So it bred in me a sense that people can get on together, certainly people of different religions. When I asked my father at about that time, how did these different religions sort of relate to one another? Because we went to each other's services at the school I went to, which was a Catholic school. He said, look, they're different sides of the same pyramid leading to the same God. And so I left with that feeling. I also left with the feeling that, look, things can get pretty tough in life. And having been fortunate myself, I certainly feel I want to help others who are less fortunate get the same break I got.
So let's track that path for a moment. You obviously were a diligent and a good student, and then went on to set up what in itself was a pioneering firm in the form of Apax Partners. Tell us a little bit about Apax Partners. What led you to set it up? Because I think it's such a logical step into the subsequent part of your life.
Well, I studied philosophy, politics, and economics at Oxford. And when I came home, I was lucky enough to be elected president of the Oxford Union. It took up a lot of my time. And when I came up in my third year before my entrance exams to have a chat with my dad about the future, I said, what am I going to do with my degree? I needed to be financially independent because my parents would need my help. That was quite clear. And my dad said, why don't you go to Harvard Business School? Now, I never thought of Harvard Business School. I don't know how he came to think of Harvard Business School. But the idea is an idea I liked. And going to Harvard Business School really gave me an insight that I could not have had I stayed in the UK, because I arrived in 1967, a long time ago now, just at the beginning of the tech revolution. And I heard speakers, and I became aware of the fact that this new thing was beginning to occur, of young companies beginning to challenge old established ones with their technology and their innovation, and that it was a way to do good and to do well at the same time. Britain at that time had 3 million unemployed. It was, for me, an opportunity to do something new and meaningful and achieve financial independence if I was fortunate enough to be successful. So I left Harvard with the idea of setting up something which became Apax, which would focus on the ability of young companies to expand internationally, develop new technologies, and so on. And it took a number of years before we could raise our first fund in Europe. But we raised our first fund in 1981, 9 years after we kicked off. We acted as advisors in the intervening years on financial transactions, expansion of companies, raising money, and so on, sort of corporate finance activity. And in 1981, when we launched our first venture capital fund, it was the largest fund in Europe, together with one of our competitors, Advent International, £10 million, nothing. The largest fund Apax has raised to date is 11 billion euros. And you know, and that was 25 years later. So you're right when you say that it has informed a lot of my activities since leaving Apax, because what happened with venture capital and tech, I now see happening with the impact investment field and the impact revolution.
So you started with, or maybe you didn't start, but certainly one of the kind of innovations that you are most closely associated with is social impact bonds. And for people who are not au fait with this idea, can you try and do a social impact bond for dummies? Give us a little bit of a sense of what they are, why they're so interesting and innovative, and why they are expanding to fields beyond those which you initially conceived of.
Well, I'll explain a little bit of background and then give you an example. That's the best way to answer your question, Paul. The situation in 2000, when we published the report of the Social Investment Task Force, was one where if you were trying to improve the lives of others, you couldn't access investment capital. You could only access donations. And if you looked around the system that the philanthropy had developed over centuries, had achieved, it wasn't very impressive. Although there were huge amounts of money, when you looked at the recipients of the money, charities trying to help people through their services, people in need, The two characteristics you noticed were very few charities had any money and very few had scale. And so the conclusion was there must be a way of connecting investment with the activities of social entrepreneurs. It took us 10 years to define that way. And that way came from two of my young colleagues, Toby Eccles and Emily Bolton at Social Finance, which is a not-for-profit that we created 3 years earlier. And they came into my office and they said, you know, we've been talking about how we prevent young prisoners from going back to jail within 18 months. How do we prevent them from going back to jail at all? What do you think if we link a reduction in the number that go back to jail to a financial return for investors? And I said to them, wow, you have found the key to the capital markets, to the investment market, for not-for-profits, for social entrepreneurs. And at that time, it seemed like a major innovation because you could now, if you were working for a charity, if you measured what you were achieving in homelessness or in education or in health or whichever area you devoted your efforts to, then you could sign a contract that said, if I improve the lives of so many people, I will get paid so much, either by the government or by philanthropists. And that's the social impact bond. There are now over 150 in 29 countries dealing with about 15 different social issues. And it sort of gives the opportunity to social entrepreneurs using a charitable structure to go out and raise money like a business. You can prove what you've been able to achieve. You can pay a return to investors. And based on that, you can go back and raise more money.
So you've witnessed the growth. You were there at the birth, arguably, of venture capital and private equity as a field, and you've witnessed its growth and maturation. You were there at the beginning and played an absolutely central role in the birth of impact investing and are witnessing its institutionalization and maturation. Tell us in what ways the impact investing field is evolving and maturing, and should that be a source of great hope for us as it does so?
So, in retrospect, the social impact bond was the first example of something which is going to come to transform our whole system. It was the first time you had a security that delivered a combination of risk, return, and measurable impact. It never happened before. Sure, people had done things and invested and created impact as a consequence, but they had never invested in something whose goal was a social improvement and made money at an acceptable level of risk. And I discovered when chairing the G8 task force, which David Cameron, who was then prime minister, asked me to do, which had as its objective to catalyze impact investment across the world. I discovered then, with the feedback that came in from the different organizations we'd set up in each of the G7 countries and Australia, that this exemplified, the social impact bond exemplified a growing trend. And the growing trend was that values had changed and were creating change. It started possibly with the younger generation of people, members of the Conduit, certainly many of the members of the Conduit are part of that generation, a generation that looks for greater meaning than just making money, doesn't want to consume the products of companies that it doesn't shared values with, doesn't want to work for those companies either. And if it's in a position to invest, doesn't want to invest in companies that pollute the world and create social issues, wants to invest in companies that bring solutions. And at the same time, Paul, you had an older generation that was very worried about the type of world we had created and were perpetuating, the world into which they would retire. And they became focused on how their pension money was being invested. And what sense did it make to invest in companies that worsened the world when they were going to retire into it and reap the consequences? And so you had these two forces coming together with a feeling on their part, the part of the general population and the part of government, that however much money government threw at these issues, it could never manage to solve them. They just kept deepening and broadening. And so we published the report called The Invisible Heart of Markets, which basically said these different forces are pushing us to a change in capitalism, which amounts to a revolution. And instead of just thinking in terms of balancing risk and return in making an investment, we're all going to be optimizing, to use the investment language, risk, return, and impact. And the social impact bond was just the first example of that. And of course, now we're seeing impact private equity, we're seeing impact venture capital, we're seeing impact property funds. We're beginning to see trillions, $30 trillion today, going to environmental, social, and governance investment, about a third of market capitalization of stock exchanges across the world today, is flowing to strategies that at least seek to prevent harm to the environment and to people. Impact investment goes further. Impact investment says, if you measure your impact and you can therefore seek to increase it and manage it, then you're an impact investor. If you simply invest in the hope of creating impact, that's welcome. But you really should measure. And there are big efforts today in which I'm involved to create a new set of financial statements, taking our existing financial statements and weighting them for the product impact that your company creates, the employment impact it creates, and the environmental impact it creates, so that you end up with an impact-weighted profit line which reflects both your financial and your impact performance.
The story you tell of a new generation of consumers and a current generation of retirees, both for different reasons, demanding that in their purchasing and in their allocation of their pensions, that capital produces not just a financial, but also a social and environmental return, is compelling in to the extent that we think that the market is going to respond with enough speed to address the depth of the crisis that we're in. And given the fact that this is arguably the first time that humanity is on a clock and that the environmental crisis is real and escalating, how optimistic are you that the markets and these forces that you've just described, which are so benevolent and so wonderful in so many ways, will lead us to measures that are urgent enough to address the scale of the problem?
So we saw the tech revolution transform all our lives in 25 or 30 years. It's not an exaggeration to say that impact thinking can transform our lives in the same sort of time period. I think within 10 years, by 2030, the date on which we hope to achieve the social development goes. I think by then, what we define as impact measurement, which is the intention to create impact and the measurement of the impact created, could amount to $30 trillion, which is actually the gap today between the capital available to achieve the SDGs and the capital that's required. The way it's going to happen is through advances such as those I've described with impact-weighted financial accounts in impact measurement. If you could today, in addition to impact private equity, venture capital, infrastructure, property, which will amount to a couple of trillion, in addition to social bonds and green bonds and blue bonds, which could amount to 8 trillion, 10% of the bond market. And if you could add measurements to a quarter of the companies in environmental, social, and governance investing, you would begin to see real impact being delivered, meaning you would begin to see companies going in the direction that's going to give them the best impact-weighted profit. They will deal with populations that are underserved at lower price levels than they've been able to do. And my assessment as an investor is that the profit that you can deliver by balancing risk, return, and impact will be greater than just by balancing risk and return. Because by balancing the three dimensions, you begin to avoid certain risks of taxation, of regulation, of consumers leaving you, of talent leaving you, of investors deserting you. And you begin to open the door to new sets of opportunities where you look at huge populations and try to work out how your company's products, be they tech or non-tech, can have the maximum impact. And the answer is usually by accessing a much bigger population at a lower price. And so I believe that the efficient frontier for investment is going to be more favorable if you invest with impact as a dimension than if you don't. And we're beginning to see it. We're beginning to see the value of tobacco companies fall, the value of coal companies fall, companies that are using child labor see an immediate reaction in the consumption and their share price and so on and so forth when it's announced. So it's happening already. The impact revolution is here.
Many people at the Conduit, particularly people who are at earlier stages in their careers and who see, both believe in and see and anticipate this revolution that you've described, are thinking how they best prepare themselves for that. What do they study? How do they forge careers? You came of age and forged your career and you built things, but what advice would you give to them? What advice did you give to your own now adult children in terms of preparing yourself for this, what sounds like actually a very exciting and interesting world of opportunity that also leads to an improved planet?
So the advice I give young people, which I gave in my book, The Second Bounce of the Ball, is start young, think big, and stick with it. Mark Zuckerberg and Bill Gates didn't have much preparation for what they did, but they thought differently. Their minds were prepared for a new world, which embraced technology and what technology could do. And so I think while if you're going to university or business school and so on, it's important that you take advantage of any courses that exist around impact investment or, approaches to solving social issues through business, whatever it may be. It's really more a question of mindset than of preparation. If you're going to be an entrepreneur, then try and build a business model that has impact at its core. If you're going to build up a fintech company, then try to build the fintech company that helps the poorer balance their financial lives more effectively, refinance their indebtedness more cheaply, and improve their lives significantly. Whatever your activity, you have the ability to influence management to take impact into account. So if you're an employee of a big company, you can express your views and you can begin to change the mindset within that company. Similarly, if you're an investor, you can innovate in the same way that we innovated with venture capital and now people are innovating with ESG. You can innovate as an investment manager. And this mindset of doing good and doing well is something that you can implement so that you do well as doing good. I believe we're going to see unicorns that are not just worth $1 billion, but touch a billion lives, improve a billion lives. And so in the same way that when I first heard the initial flotation about the initial flotations of tech companies in the US, I felt, wow, this is going to be big. This is something that I want to get involved with. I think today, young people who are attracted to the notion of impact should just find a way of connecting with a business opportunity or with employment that furthers the impact that they can deliver.
Everything you say is so infused with optimism. And I think I always like to hear from people, as I am, who just by inclination an optimist and have a great faith in humanity's ability to address big problems, to hear from them what they're worried about and where they think there are big challenges in the world. Not because we want to dwell on them, but because it's often good to see them clearly for the challenges that they are so that we are able to confront them and overcome them. So what worries Sir Ronald Cohen today?
Well, there's a lot to worry about, but there always has been a lot to worry about, is the truth. The stage when I was a university student, it was nuclear disarmament and the threat to the planet. Well, we kicked that ball into touch for a few decades. It's coming back now. I think today the biggest concern is that we're seeing our society threatened by the huge inequalities that our system has created. And our system served us well for a couple of centuries. It created growth. Growth took a lot of people out of poverty. But an aspect of the system was the negative consequences that it created, both social and environmental. And with the scale of industrialization, we can no longer cope with these consequences. We have a system where companies create negative consequences and governments tax us all to try to remedy them. Clearly, it's self-defeating. And so the thing that I worry about most is how do you provide better opportunity, greater social mobility, reduce the inequalities in the system so that the system appears to be fair. We will never have total equality. But if everybody has a shot at opportunity, then the system persists. Today, we have a system where if you're born into a certain type of family, you're basically condemned to staying where you are. By your birth. And that's why I think impact investment is so important. Because if every company becomes an ally of government in using its managerial capacity, its ability to access huge sums of capital, its the skills and talent of its employees to deliver products that improve lives and the environment, then we really can have a world where we regenerate our planet and we improve people's lives and we enable people to grab hold of opportunities. People don't want charity, they want a chance.
It seems in your career you've helped finance some companies which have been an enormous source of job creation. You spotted and saw the technology revolution as it was beginning to happen. If you look today at the aggregate employment of Google and Facebook and Apple and contrast that with the employment of General Motors or Ford or General Electric, older industrial companies, and then look at their overall net revenues, the new technology companies are much more efficient and employ fewer people and therefore concentrate wealth more. And I wonder if you know of or have thought about how impact investing can help create jobs in a world where the workforce is changing, inequality is growing. Where are the clues? We obviously, there's no silver bullet, but where are the clues of how we can address this big structural problem?
Well, one of the clues is in frequent reskilling. We've lived in slower technology environments where jobs could actually change very little over decades. We're into a different world now. The pace of technological change is changing the business models of companies and changing their recruitment needs, the talent that they want to bring in for the next stage of their growth. This requires reskilling. And if we begin to think in terms of how do we reskill people, do we just ask a government to do it through, the usual way with government expending money to do things? Or do we try to bring investor capital in the same way that we brought investment capital to fund the tech revolution and have those organizations which have been funded by investors derive the return for the investors by payment at the end, either from government or from philanthropists or from aid organizations, when people have actually been reskilled and gone into jobs? If you compare the two, intuitively, I think most people would come to the conclusion, look, it's much more likely to work better if you have clear objectives, clear targets, and investment capital behind you than if the government is funding it. So I think we're going to see a shift in the way the government expends as well. I think governments will move to pay for success. Pay for success will attract investment capital opposite. Impact investment can help to tackle social issues the government has found it difficult to tackle. Issues like homelessness, dropout rates from school, prevention of many things, prevention of diabetes, for instance, already has attracted capital through social impact bonds. So there is a new approach to reskilling that is possible that doesn't require government to tax us more. Fund activities itself that makes government dollars go further, basically.
So a final question. Do you think that the challenge in this new and exciting world of impact investing is that there is insufficient capital but thousands or hundreds of thousands of remarkable companies that are rising to tackle these challenges, or there is a growing pool of capital but insufficient companies, or do you think that, you know, we've achieved some degree of equilibrium? Where should we be investing our time and energy in order to address what is both an incredible threat but also a wonderful opportunity?
We've already seen it with venture capital, that the supply of money creates its own demand, but with a lag. When it becomes easier to raise money, as you know, Paul, entrepreneurs get on their bikes and go and raise it. When it looks very difficult to raise money, then you have fewer entrepreneurs doing it, and you attract fewer people from well-paid jobs to take the risk of building a company. The market in impact investment is growing fast. Today, the impact investment market with measurement of impact as a central feature of it, is estimated to be about $500 billion. So not a very big market compared to $100 trillion roughly in our stock exchanges and quoted shares. But it's a new field, and we're seeing less entrepreneurs coming to raise that money at the moment. And so those who've raised the money are using the skills of their teams to originate jobs, and pretty quickly you will find that that money gets invested, and then there's a shortage of money relative to the demand, and new and bigger funds will be raised. So venture capital went from zero to venture capital and private equity together to $7 trillion in 25 years. But it went through this process of leads and lags and catching up. I think it's much easier today to raise money than it used to be. But at the same time, I see very few business plans of young entrepreneurs that don't have a section on impact. Most of the businesses that I come across today are measuring some type of impact and have impact objectives, most of the young businesses. And so I think if you're an entrepreneur thinking about a venture today, adding an impact dimension to it improves your chances of success. It doesn't reduce them.
Sir Ronald Cohen, you have been a great inspiration to a great many of us working in this field. Anybody who's listened to this will be able to chart out a life which hopefully is as admirable as yours has been. And for that, we should all be enormously grateful. So thank you.
Thank you very much.
Thank you so much for listening to this episode of Conduit Conversations. Feel free to subscribe. This podcast is available on all major podcast platforms. Please also visit theconduit.com, where you can find more information on The Conduit and our community of changemakers.